Now stay tuned for the Sunday morning wake-up call on 97.9 The Wren. The wake-up call talks with the people in Charlottesville and Albemarle County who are making a difference. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
And thank you for being here with us again on another Sunday morning. Today, we're going to talk about the Voting Rights Act from past, present, to future with University of Virginia Professor Kevin Gaines. Professor Gaines is the Julian Bond Professor of Civil Rights and Social Justice with a joint appointment in the Carter G. Woodson Institute for African American and African Studies, along with UVA's Department of History. Professor Gaines' current research is on the problems and projects of racial integration in the United States during and after the Civil Rights Movement. He's the author of several prize-winning books, including Uplifting the Race, Black Leadership, Politics, and Culture During the 20th Century. Professor Gaines, welcome back to Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call.
Thanks, Rick, for having me back on the program.
Well, always glad to have you. So, Voting Rights Act. Voting rights have certainly been a major topic of conversation for the past year, especially this summer and a little before. But I wanted to go back a little further, learn a little bit, help listeners of interest learn a little bit. And in doing a little research, it took me all the way back to the 15th Amendment, although it may take, you may take us back a little further. Can you start at the 15th Amendment and flesh it out a little bit?
Well, Rick, I could do that, but I feel like we need to step back a little bit earlier and really talk about the story of voting rights in the United States. And really, it's a story of the gradual expansion of voting rights from property-owning white males in 1787, which is a very restrictive notion of voting rights, to one person, one vote, which was achieved in 1965 by the Voting Rights Act. And, of course, the Voting Rights Act was the landmark act of legislation passed by Congress in 1965 that was probably the most impactful legislative reform of the Civil Rights Movement. It really took the Civil Rights Movement of the 1960s to guarantee the right to vote for all Americans. And that was the Voting Rights Act. Not only were African Americans made full citizens with the right to vote, the Voting Rights Act, confirmed the voting rights of Native Americans. Native Americans had been eligible to vote as citizens since the 1920s, but many states wouldn't enforce voting rights for Native Americans. So the Voting Rights Act really guaranteed the right to vote for all Americans. And, the thing is, after the Voting Rights Act, for the next 50 years, there was a bipartisan consensus that supported voting rights, for all, mostly in principle, if not always in practice. And then, more recently, we've seen challenges to voting rights and the Voting Rights Act. We'll get into this later, but those challenges really began in the 2010s, and that's a period that begins with the Obama administration, which, the election of the first black president would have to be seen as, a sort of a culmination of the voting rights and the promise that that entailed for the country in terms of in terms of inclusion and diversity. But, there was a period for about 50 years or so when there was a bipartisan consensus in support of voting rights. And by the 2010s, that consensus of support from both parties, Republican and Democratic, for voting rights starts to erode, and you start to see state laws that are making it more difficult to vote. And you start to see also partisan state election officials, and not to be partisan, but they're usually Republican, who are administering elections with a bias toward Republicans, and that means really compromising the voting rights of African-American voters. So that's kind of the whole progression of with the Voting Rights Act as being this kind of culminating moment in terms of decades of struggle, finally realizing the promise of liberal democracy in America and granting full citizenship to all Americans.
Well, you mentioned to all Americans. One of the things in, again, to not to push the 15th Amendment, but because you used that phrase, one of the things that I learned in doing a little reading on the 15th Amendment was that it was specifically written to the right to vote, not denied by race, rather than to give everyone the right to vote, which I found, I don't think I'm reading that right on my notes here, but it was interesting in that it was written a specific way so as not to give the right to vote to everyone, but that the right to vote was not denied by race. Is that correct?
Absolutely, yeah. And the reason for that is the context, the occasion of 19th century American politics, and the fact that this question of the citizenship of African Americans was, a really sort of a intense controversy during the 19th century. You have to remember that during the 19th century, the dominant view of American political culture was that the U.S., the United States, was a white man's country. And so when people thought of citizenship and voting rights in the 19th century, and this is before the Civil War, you know, they thought of white men. And eventually they expanded suffrage. You had universal adult male suffrage, universal adult white male suffrage. And, of course, women couldn't vote, even though there was a woman suffrage movement at that time before the Civil War. Now, the question of citizenship and whether African Americans could be considered U.S. citizens was a major bone of contention in American politics. On the eve of the Civil War, African Americans, and these are pre-African Americans, at the time before the Civil War, there were almost about 500,000 African Americans who were not slaves, who had legally the status of free blacks. African Americans could vote in a handful of New England states, but free blacks in the North in general faced restrictions on suffrage, were banned from voting. And then the Civil War and the emancipation of 4 million formerly enslaved people in the South raised this question of, what would be the status of the 4 million former slaves, in the South? And so black abolitionists like Frederick Douglass said that freedom by itself wasn't enough, especially since black men had taken up arms to join the Union Army and had fought the same Union. And so Douglass and others demanded that black people at this time, black abolitionists, but also white abolitionists too, they basically demanded that black people, and again, we're talking about black men, must have the right to vote. They must be full citizens of the United States. And at this time, the Republican Party was the party of Abraham Lincoln. It was the party of emancipation. It was the party of black voting rights. And what happened after emancipation was the former planter class try to continue the oppression and enslavement of the freed enslaved people. And they were really digging in. They were passing laws to try to reinstitute slavery. And so that led Republicans in Congress to enact federal guarantees of citizenship for African Americans. And Republicans in Congress felt this was a moral imperative. You had to safeguard the rights of the formerly enslaved after their brutal oppression, you know, for centuries. It was the right thing to do. And they also felt that this needed to be done after the nation was torn apart and nearly destroyed by the Civil War. So Republicans used their majorities in Congress to pass three Civil War amendments to the Constitution. And I'm sure that, you know, your listeners are familiar with these. The 13th Amendment outlawed slavery. The 14th Amendment to the Constitution defined federal citizenship for all persons born on U.S. soil without respect to race or former condition of servitude. And then the 15th Amendment, finally, we've gotten there to talk about the 15th Amendment. As you said, the 15th Amendment said that no state shall abridge the right to vote of any person due to race, color, or previous servitude. Now, they had to be explicit in discussing race and the history of enslavement, really because of the precedent that was established by the Dred Scott decision of the Supreme Court in 1857. And Dred Scott was a slave who traveled with his enslaver to free territory, and so he to raise the question legally, if I'm living in a territory where slavery is illegal, doesn't that make me free? And so he brought suit to sued for his freedom, and the Supreme Court ruled no, you can't sue because black people are not and never will be citizens of the United States with any kind of legal standing to bring suits in court. So the Dred Scott decision basically ruled that black people, black Americans, could not be citizens. So the 15th Amendment, the Civil War amendments, and some of the other Civil Rights Acts that were passed by Congress, after the Civil War, basically codified African Americans as citizens of the federal government. They were, in fact, citizens. So the 15th Amendment and these other amendments and other laws that grant citizenship rights to African Americans overturn that infamous decision by the Supreme Court that said that black people could not be citizens of the United States. So that's why the language of the 15th Amendment and to some extent the language of the other amendments, because we're dealing with a class of people who were formerly enslaved on the basis of race, that's why the 15th Amendment has to be explicit in its language no state shall abridge the right to vote of any person due to race, color, or previous servitude. It was because race, the difference between being black and white, was, just the absolute determinant of one's citizenship status and thus one's voting rights.
We are here talking today with Professor Kevin Gaines about the Voting Rights Act, sort of a prelude to it. And we're going to get to the present state as well as the future in a little bit. Professor Kevin Gaines, Department of History, as well as the Institute for African American and African Studies. So, Professor, sort of a roller coaster in voting rights for African American males, correct? The 15th Amendment comes about, but then in 1890 or so, voting rights are taken away from black people in the South. And then the Voting Rights Act itself doesn't come about until 1965.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, you look at the history of voting rights in the United States, and you look at African-American history in the United States, and you have these dramatic periods of advancement, of an expansion of rights and freedom and democracy. And then you have these shocking periods of, you know, backlash, of retrogression, of, you know, the stripping away of the rights, both social and political, that African-Americans had enjoyed. You sort of wonder what it must have felt like for African-Americans who, from slavery to freedom, and then invested in all those hopes of, you know, being able to sort of make a life as full citizens of the United States, and then eventually having to experience, first gradually, but later, you know, suddenly, this loss of status, this loss of hard-won rights that had been gained earlier. I feel like we're almost in a similar kind of moment to that today. But just to backtrack a little bit, you know, African Americans, as I said, gained the right to vote after the Civil War, and were able to vote and elect African American representatives to office in the South. And this is the first time that black people were recognized as citizens of the United States. And historians call these momentous changes the second founding of the United States, this period after the Civil War and during the period that historians call Reconstruction, which is the process by which the former Confederate states were brought back into the Union. So African Americans, this is a period of hope. African Americans embrace the opportunity to vote and participate in public life. They elected representatives to offices from the federal government down to local, you know, municipal offices. And, you know, of course, all of these changes were accomplished over the bitter opposition of the former Confederate leaders, former enslavers, and basically the Democratic Party in the South. The Democratic Party in the South was the party of white supremacy. The Republican Party in the South, interestingly enough, was the party of black civil rights, black political rights, the voting rights. So, you know, the 15th Amendment opens up this revolutionary period in the United States. You know, this was a period of power sharing under Reconstruction governments in the South, power sharing between blacks and whites. And Reconstruction was a social revolution. Those amendments to the Constitution redefined citizenship and made African Americans full citizens of the U.S. As I said, that overturned the Supreme Court's Dred Scott decision that said black people could never be U.S. citizens. And it was a new vision of democracy. It was a vision of multiracial democracy over and above the previous vision of democracy, which was democracy for white men only. And Republicans passed laws in Reconstruction governments banning racial discrimination and guaranteeing equality before the law. And so Reconstruction was a really momentous time in the United States. And you mentioned the period later in the 19th century when African Americans were systematically stripped of their voting rights throughout the South. We can pick that up, but Reconstruction is probably one of the more democratic periods in the history of the U.S. South. African American men served in elective office. Reconstruction state governments established universal public education and built schools. And this is the first time that happened in the South, that governments actually administered to broader public needs of the entire population. Reconstruction governments defended the interests of agricultural workers. They passed laws making taxation more equitable. And they also outlawed racial discrimination in public transportation. So, needless to say, Reconstruction governments accomplished a lot, but they had constant and violent opposition from the Democratic Party and white supremacists and people who wanted to reinstate the rule of the former enslavers.
We're here Sunday morning wake-up call talking with UVA Professor Kevin Gaines, Institute for African American and African Studies, as we talk about the Voting Rights Act, sort of a prelude up to the present and into the future. Be right back. And here we are, Sunday morning wake-up call, UVA Professor Kevin Gaines talking about voting rights. Professor, you were talking about Reconstruction.
That's right. Reconstruction was this period, this brief period of power sharing between blacks and whites in the South, a period in which African Americans served in governments throughout the South. And of course, white Democrats opposed Reconstruction and black voting rights and office holding. And they made these arguments. They opposed it on states' rights grounds, that, you know, it was just not legitimate for the federal government to come in and impose this this system of governance. And then, you know, there was anti-black prejudice, which was deep-seated in American society. Many whites just in the South just couldn't stand former slaves voting, holding office, serving on juries, and so they violently opposed these changes. You saw the rise of the Ku Klux Klan and other terror groups in the 1870s. And so support for Reconstruction begins to wane quickly. And Reconstruction ends in 1877 when federal troops are removed from the South. And so you have no more peacekeeping force to uphold Reconstruction governments. And this brings in a new phase of Southern politics that, you know, we refer to as Jim Crow segregation. And then later, disenfranchisement. Southern politics is taken over by those former Confederates and Southern whites who were hostile to black voting rights. And so from 1890 to 1908, Southern states rewrote their constitutions to deprive African Americans of voting rights. Effectively, these changes to state constitutions overturned the 15th Amendment. And so what's also happening at this time is that the North and the Republican Party, who have been stalwart champions of voting rights for black people, they lose interest in defending voting rights. And the Republican Party becomes, instead of the party of civil rights and voting rights, the Republican Party becomes the party of big business and corporations. And disfranchisement, the removal of black people from the voting rolls, is accomplished through race-neutral means. You know, the motivation is explicitly racist, but the mechanisms are race-neutral. You know, they devise taxes, literacy tests, constitutional quizzes, even so-called grandfather clauses that basically say that you could vote, but only if you were descended from somebody who could legally vote before 1867. So this disenfranchisement of black voters effectively meant the elimination of black elected officials from Southern politics. And it was also accomplished through violence. This is a period where you start to see a rise in racial terror lynchings and political violence. In Wilmington, North Carolina, in 1898, armed white supremacists turned their guns on black and white Republican elected officials, killed some, ran the rest out of town, and basically installed a white supremacist government. So, you know, Reconstruction got a real bad name within the U.S. Academy during the era of Jim Crow. Even President Woodrow Wilson really subscribed to this negative view of Reconstruction, that African Americans were unfit to vote and to serve in electoral office. And, you know, throughout the era of segregation, the white supremacists were elected to Congress under the Democratic Party, which is still the party of white supremacy in the South. They're basically saying that, you know, we tried that, we tried black voting rights, we're never going to do that again, you know, and they're basing this on their, you know, racist notions of black inferiority. So the era of segregation, which is roughly from, I guess you could say, the 1880s until the modern civil rights movement gains momentum in the 50s and 60s, that's a period in which voting rights is at the center of the civil rights and freedom agenda for African Americans.
So the next time that there is a super significant change in voting rights is the Voting Rights Act itself in 1965. Is that correct?
Well, yes and no. It's a long road to the Voting Rights Act of 1965. It's really important to realize that one of the changes, the major social changes that really created the conditions for the modern civil rights movement and later the passage of the Voting Rights Act, was the Great Migration. You know, black people are subject to political exclusion and violence in the South, as well as the exploitation under, the sharecropping system. So after World War I, many African Americans, by the hundreds of thousands, start leaving the Deep South and moving to cities in the North and the Midwest, starting in the 20s, but certainly during the years between World War I and World War II. And so what happens is that the 15th Amendment functions in the North. African Americans who moved from the South and are populating these northern cities can vote. They have voting rights. They establish these communities, and their votes within the context of these segregated black communities that they form give them a certain amount of political clout. So the black vote by around World War II becomes a factor in swing states like Michigan and Illinois. And so many black voters in the North saw their political power as a weapon to secure rights for disenfranchised black people in the South. And again, there's two Democratic parties. There's the Democratic Party in the Deep South, which is the party of white supremacy, a party of one-party rule in the Jim Crow South. And then there's the Democratic Party in the North, in which, you know, the children of immigrants and African Americans are part of these, I guess you could call them machine politics, urban governments in northern cities like Chicago, Detroit, et cetera. And there, African Americans have the vote, and those communities, those black communities in the North, are really the sort of the political base of the civil rights movement, of organizations like the NAACP. So the Great Migration really is game-changing in that it allows African Americans to gradually enter the political system and to build up some political clout that puts pressure on national administrations like the Truman administration to actively support civil rights, if they want to get elected and if they want to get the African American vote.
UVA Professor Kevin Gaines with us today as we talk about voting rights. And so, Professor, I keep bringing it up because that's where we are. That's what we keep talking about today. And I'm trying to figure out how this Voting Rights Act of 1965 gets gutted in 2013 and then gets all sorts of voting rights get, I don't even know the word to choose, additional voting rights get added and subtracted in the last few years.
Yeah. I mean, that's a huge question, and you know, the Voting Rights Act is really the culmination of the civil rights movement. You know, you had black people in the South marching against segregation and public transportation and accommodations in places like Montgomery and Birmingham. Voting rights is always there as an objective. You know, states like Mississippi and Alabama were the states that were most violent in their opposition to voting rights. And the reason for that was because they had relatively large black populations, particularly in some counties where blacks were near majorities. And so, you know, the most famous voting rights campaign was in Selma, Alabama, during the civil rights movement. And the event that everybody remembers is Bloody Sunday. And you had nonviolent marchers for voting rights, men and women, who were led by John Lewis, who was a civil rights leader. They're beaten and tear gassed by Alabama state troopers on the Edmund Pettus Bridge. And this was caught on camera. These sickening images of police brutality, they were shown on the national news. They were shown worldwide. There's worldwide revulsion. And so Selma and the Bloody Sunday, this attack, violent attack on nonviolent protesters was a turning point, and the national and international outrage fueled the passage of the Voting Rights Act. And this transformed American society. So finally, America is a true liberal democracy, but of course it did so at a great cost. This happened not before several more black and white voting rights campaigners are killed by violent black supremacists. So the Voting Rights Act actually had strong enforcement provisions. Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, and the Voting Rights Act, of course, bans any discrimination in voting. But Section 5 had this key provision of preclearance, and it held that the Justice Department must approve any proposed changes in voting rules in states with a history of voter discrimination, namely the former Jim Crow states. And so what that meant was, you know, and of course, there were legal challenges to the Voting Rights Act immediately right out the box. You know, southern jurisdictions tried to declare it unconstitutional, and it was upheld by the Supreme Court. They said that basically, in the past few decades, the law has favored the ability of the perpetrators of discrimination to prevail, and we feel that Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, which requires any changes in voting rules be pre-approved by the Justice Department, we feel that that provision finally takes the side of the people who were in need of, anti-discrimination remedy. So it finally sides with, you know, the long-suffering and disenfranchised African-Americans in the South. Now, the Voting Rights Act was reauthorized a few times in the 1970s and the 1980s, and what they did was they followed congressional hearings in which people testified to new forms of voting discrimination. So these reauthorizations of the Voting Rights Act were basically meant to sort of address these new forms of exclusion. In New York, they were found to some governments were discriminating on the basis of language. And so... the Voting Rights Act was just sort of tweaked to make sure that, the access to the vote was not compromised in any way. Now, you mentioned the Supreme Court's decision in 2013, and this is, a momentous decision, probably as infamous a decision as the Dred Scott decision that I mentioned earlier. But in 2013, in Shelby County v. Holder, the Supreme Court struck down that really powerful enforcement provision in the Voting Rights Act, Section 5. And in the opinion, the majority opinion, and this was a 5-4 vote by a closely divided Supreme Court, Chief Justice John Roberts said, Well, look, I mean, voter registration rates among blacks and whites are pretty much the same throughout the South. But, you know, the discrimination is not a problem anymore, so we don't need this act. And you know, that was basically the signal for all kinds of new proposed legislation at the state level to restrict access to the suffrage.
So let me ask you a quick question in here. With some of the more moderate decisions that Chief Justice Roberts has been seen making in the last few years, and some of the voting rights activity that have taken place in states like Texas and Georgia and Florida and Arizona, has there been any thought that Chief Justice Roberts may be reevaluating his Shelby decision?
I don't think so. I mean, I think that Chief Justice Roberts has been opposed to voting rights ever since he was a lawyer in the Reagan administration's Justice Department. I think Roberts's jurisdiction, at least on issues of civil rights, voting rights, race in general, is that Roberts assumes equality. He assumes a situation of equality. And if you have equality, you don't really need any kind of proactive response from the courts to remedy discrimination. You know, Roberts, in another decision, basically striking down school desegregation programs in Seattle and I believe Kentucky, basically said the way to, this is what Roberts said, the way to stop discriminating by race is to stop discriminating by race. So Roberts doesn't really believe in the kind of enforcement mechanism that was enshrined in Section 5, where you needed to have that kind of enforcement to protect the interests of black voters from those who are hostile to voting rights. Roberts would prefer to just wish that kind of intent those who would attack the voting rights of African Americans or anyone else. He would just defer to that.
Again, our guest today is University of Virginia Professor Kevin Gaines, as we talk about voting rights. We'll be right back. And thank you for being with us today. Sunday morning wake-up call. Rick Moore, Professor Kevin Gaines. So, Professor, there's as we talk about present day and what the Shelby County v. Holder Act from 2013 did, there's a lot that's been happening just in the last couple of years. The more recent notes that I found, 19 states have already enacted over 30 laws this year that will make it harder for Americans to vote. Things such as making mail voting and early voting more difficult, impose harsher voter ID requirements, make faulty voter purges more likely. Although 25 states have enacted 50 or more laws with provisions to expand voting access, expand access to early and mail voting, make voter registration easier, and restore voting rights to Americans with past convictions. Can you talk about this for a bit? The differentiation in states, not in maybe a specific manner, but about how, I mean, you either fall in one category or the other, seemingly.
Yeah. You know, I mentioned earlier that voting rights was a bipartisan issue. There was bipartisan support for voting rights. And that seems to have ended. You know, voting rights and voter suppression now has become a pretty constant dividing line between Republicans and Democrats. And Republicans tend to want to limit voting by making it harder to vote, and Democrats have wanted to make it easier. And you know, prominent Republicans, including the former President Trump, you know, have been on record saying that, you know, it's better for them politically if many people don't vote. And they you know, Trump said that if people were able to vote freely, then the Republicans would never win an election ever. And just to give you some context on that, over the last 30 years or so, a Republican candidate, the president, has won the popular vote only one time, and that was George W. Bush in 2004. The other time that Republicans won the White House, that was George W. Bush in 2000 and Donald Trump in 2016, they lost the popular vote, and they were able to win through the Electoral College. So the American politics has become partisan, and a lot of these states where you see these new laws proposed to limit voting are closely divided states politically. There are 50-50 states in which every election, every statewide election and every presidential election is extremely close. And so voter suppression has long been practiced by the Republican Party. It was, you know, practiced in 2000, in the 2000 election, in the crucial and decisive state of Florida, because it's such a, you know, a battleground state. But now, with the 2020 election, you know, we see these old arguments that were used to justify voter ID laws, that they were for voter integrity, that they were going to protect voter fraud. You know, they claimed that they were for ballot security. It seems like now, you know, the mask is off, and these laws are really showing this contempt for the voting rights of African Americans, and really the voting rights of anybody who votes Democratic.
Well, can I ask you quickly? There are certainly the comment that it's the rights to vote, but if you read it the other way, when you go in and read what these voting changes are, it just depends on which media source you're reading it in as to how it's presented. And some of them, many of them, are then presented as not as a loss of a right to vote, but as a right to ensure accuracy. Is there a way to do both? Keep the vote and ensure accuracy.
Well, here's the thing. In the 2020 election, by all observers, that was the most successful election in U.S. history in terms of turnout, in terms of the fairness of the election, in terms of you know, minimal instances of fraud. So it's interesting that in response to the pandemic, election officials across the country, you know, they had drop boxes and mail-in voting and early voting periods, and you know, people took advantage of that. And, of course, you know, in the ongoing attempts to relitigate the 2020 election, after, you know, President Trump has weaponized these allegations of election fraud, you know, many courts and many election observers, Attorney General William Barr, a lot of people, many of them Republicans, you know, attested to the integrity of the election process in 2020. So I just don't buy that, you know, there's this trade-off between, an election integrity and an expanded access to the vote.
Well, then let's talk about where we're going forward, because We have just over 10 minutes left in the program today with UVA Professor Kevin Gaines as we talk about voting rights. We've done a prelude. We've done the present. I want to make sure we get a little bit into the future. Several voting rights laws or acts have been presented at the federal level, with John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act and the Freedom to Vote Act. Can you talk about either of those?
Well, I mean, these are laws. The John Lewis Act was an attempt to shore up the Voting Rights Act, to restore the preclearance measure of the Voting Rights Act, and to try to put some barriers in the way of state governments that wanted to pass laws that would restrict the suffrage. Right now, there's a whole panoply of voting rights legislation out there, and a lot of it is held up by the fact that the Senate is evenly divided, 50-50, and there are a couple of Democratic members of the Senate who are a little bit troublingly reluctant to support voting rights. These new measures are basically meant to also address this whole spate of voter suppression laws that have been passed in places like Georgia, in Texas, in Florida, and other places. They're basically meant to make it easier for people to vote. They want to extend early voting periods. They want to strengthen mail-in voting, et cetera, et cetera. Some of these voting laws, like the law in Texas, basically seem reverse engineered to basically ban all of the measures that African Americans and Latinos used in Harris County in Texas to vote in the 2020 election. And so, we really have an impasse with this moment of hyper-partisanship in politics and an evenly divided Senate in which, there's support for voting rights, but in order to have any chance of passing voting rights, you're going to have to confront this major barrier, which is the filibuster. And, the filibuster, of course, is that Senate rule that requires a 60-vote supermajority for any proposed legislation to receive a vote on the Senate floor and a 60-vote majority to pass. And so the filibuster is just a barrier to passing any law. And it really plays into the hands of Republicans in the Senate who are united in blocking voting rights legislation and pretty much all of President Biden's legislative agenda, too.
What is the expectation on actually getting anywhere with the Freedom to Vote Act so that voting rights are set on a national, federal level across all 50 states?
Yeah, I mean, the voting system in the United States, the electoral system, is kind of a mess. You've got 50 different states running elections and 50 jurisdictions, many jurisdictions actually within them. So, new federal oversight on the level of the Voting Rights Act is certainly necessary. But I think that, those voting rights laws, and there, as I said, there are several of them that are out there, any of them would be good, but there's just not enough support for them in such a divided and partisan Congress. Now, who knows? We can see some of these folks who don't want to reform or end the filibuster. Maybe there'll be a change of heart. Certainly, the stakes are high, as the Republicans are pursuing not only these voting rights, these voter suppression bills, but also laws that would potentially overturn elections, laws that would allow pro-Trump legislators to take control of election boards. And, you know, so we're not just talking about, you know, depriving African Americans or Latino people of vote. We're talking about, you know, laws that would create a scenario where the will of the voters can be overturned summarily. So it's a pretty dire crisis of democracy in this country. And it just seems like the motivation for these laws is raw power on the part of the Republican Party and a permanent minority rule. Some political scientists call it a system of competitive authoritarianism, where you have elections, but the outcome of the elections are always going to be predetermined. And right now, the people who are backing these laws, these voter suppression bills, basically, they don't care about proving whether electoral fraud exists. They ideologically believe that Democrats the votes of Democrats are less legitimate than the votes of Republicans, and that the Democrats don't deserve to rule. So what you've seen is this gradual movement from voting rights being a bipartisan issue to being an issue in which the far right of the Republican Party is profoundly hostile, not simply to voting rights, but any kind of meaningful opposition at all from Democrats.
Do you even foresee the Freedom to Vote Act coming forward for a Senate vote? Because it seems as though in the past, and I'll preface that, the current Republican Party could frequently come together to put something through or prevent something from going through. And the more recent Democratic Party could not do something similar. They were divided enough in what their hopes and dreams and expectations were that they could not get their entire caucus to vote together. So do you foresee the Freedom to Vote Act to be put forth for a vote?
Well, I certainly that eventually Democrats will come to their senses and realize that the Republican Party is playing for keeps. And, you know, it would just be a tremendous failure of nerve if Democrats were not able to sort of unite sufficiently to bring this this bill before the Senate. You know, everybody's talking about the likelihood that Republicans will take control of the House of Representatives in the midterm elections, and the window for Democrats to exercise the power that they have seems to be closing. So, I mean, that said, I think that when you have such a sustained attack on voting rights, you're going to, I think, provoke a higher turnout by Democratic voters, the voters who really turned out in 2020, young voters, voters of color, and more and more independent voters and suburban white voters. I have more faith in the electorate and an aroused electorate than I have in the Congress at this point. I think that the electorate has learned its lesson. Democrats have been less energized over the past few election cycles, certainly during the midterms, than Republicans have. Republicans found a way to rally behind Trump for all his flaws, and Democrats are always looking for the perfect candidate. And I think that's part of the reason why we're in the mess that we're in right now. But I think that the electorate certainly remembers the struggles over voting rights historically. They remember John Lewis. They remember the fact that John Lewis, you know, came back and visited Black Lives Matter Square in Washington, D.C. when he was in the final stages of his illness. And then after his death, you know, he wrote, "The vote is the most powerful nonviolent change agent you have in a democratic society. You must use it because it is not guaranteed. You can lose it." And I think that lesson has been made abundantly clear by, you know, the post-election actions of state Republican Party officials all over the country. And, you know, when you try to take something from someone, when you try to take a right that has seemed to be settled and established, you can't help but galvanize people into action. And I think we see this with voting rights. I think we're going to see this, even though this is a bit off topic, with reproductive rights as well. I just feel that there's going to be a more forceful and energized response from voters themselves, from the electorate, than the Democratic Party right now. I think they would love to have a few more seats in the Senate so that they could not have to sweat everything out. But I can't be overly optimistic given the current state of things with the Senate divided 50-50 and a couple of Democrats who just don't seem to feel the sense of urgency around this issue of voting rights or other things.
Again, our guest today, as we talked about voting rights, UVA Professor Kevin Gaines from the Department of History, as well as the Institute for African American and African Studies. Professor, thank you so much. It was such a learning experience.
Well, thank you. Always a pleasure.
All right, folks. We'll be back again next Sunday. Take care.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on Real Oldies 97.9 The Wren. The Wake Up Call is produced by Dan Gould. Show archives can be found at SeavillePodcast.com. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for The Wake Up Call, only on 97.9 The Wren.